Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. This is episode 18, and today is Wednesday, August 17th, 2011. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kai.
We had a fun time over the weekend. We went over to Dayton and met with the band Grenades that does our intro and exit music. And it was a really weird building, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was really cool.
It was, do you remember the company?
It was Huffy. It was the first Huffy.
The original Huffy factory. Mm-hmm. But just a huge building, old style. I estimated it was probably built in the early 20s.
They looked it up. It was 1920.
Mm-hmm. I knew it was right in there by looking at the architecture. It's fantastic. And it's still being used. It's still a fairly solid building, even though it looks from the outside like part of the zombie apocalypse, you know?
And from the inside as well. And
from the inside, it actually looks like the zombie apocalypse. But it's a really cool building. Everything in it is huge. Just, you know, massive rooms that they've divided up into dozens and dozens of smaller shops and studios and everything. And that's where Grenades has their sound studio, along with quite a few other bands from what they were telling us.
And art studios.
Yeah,
and
yeah. There was a wood shop in there. Mm-hmm. Did you see that guy's wood shop? Mm-hmm. Giant freight elevators and all kinds of machinery left over from the olden days. From the glory days, really, of Dayton. Mm-hmm. When 1920s, you know, Dayton was the... Well, I said this in the interview. Dayton was the Silicon Valley of its day. Yep. All the big breakthroughs were happening in and around Dayton at the time. But that was a pretty fun time we had there.
Yeah, you know, yeah, listening to the guys. Nice. And that should be coming out here, Thursday?
Probably tomorrow. We have a little bit of editing work we needed to do on it, but I think we'll probably have it put together for tomorrow. And we'll have links to their music, and we might even feature. I guess we'll feature at least one or two of their songs in the podcast that we do for that. So that'll be a special episode of Bad Quaker Podcast tomorrow, Thursday, the
18th,
because this is podcast 18.
Yes.
All right. So what's going on?
Not a whole lot, I guess. I guess, firstly, we should touch on, I don't know if anybody saw it a couple nights ago. It seems to be making the waves a little bit. Jon Stewart had a nice little segment on Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And how blatantly obvious, particularly Fox News, but, you know, the Republican Party in general. Mm-hmm. It's not just Fox News. Yeah. It's really not just Fox News. All of the mainstream media is reporting the Ames straw poll results the same way.
Yeah, like, you know, Ron Paul wasn't even there.
They'll say, you know, Michelle Bachmann was number one, and I forget his name, whoever was number three, mm-hmm. and they skip right past the number two slot. Which is funny, because if you actually look at the statistics, mm-hmm. statistically speaking, Ron Paul tied for first place.
Yeah. Well, plus, that's kind of in her backyard there.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they had this thing in Texas.
Right.
Well, I don't know. There are a lot of hardcore, old-time Republicans everywhere.
There are. And there's a good portion of the Republican Party that doesn't like Ron Paul because he doesn't pander to the religious right.
Mm-hmm. I saw AP basically said he's no longer a fringe candidate. The AP has sort of given him a quiet blessing that they'll acknowledge his existence for the time being.
How kind of them.
The way they say it in their headline here: once fringe candidate Paul shaping 2012 race. Ron Paul, once seen as a fringe candidate and a nuance to the establishment, is shaping the 2012 Republican primary by giving voice to the party's libertarian wing.
It baffles me because, you know, Ron Paul is actually an actual politician. He's been in politics for years.
Yeah, I can't remember how many, like 17 terms or something like that. I can't remember now. It's a crazy amount of time.
You know, so it's not just like some kid that they've yanked off the streets and...
Yeah, he's actually been a congressman longer than a lot of his supporters have been alive. Because a lot of his supporters are the young 20s aged people that are really excited about him. And a lot of those people weren't even born yet when he first went into politics.
Yep.
I should mention, too, an interesting thing happened this week, and I kind of let it slip by me, but Monday was the anniversary of the closing of the gold window by Richard Nixon. That's 40 years ago that day. There's a book by a guy named Robert Anton Wilson called The Illuminati Papers. It's been called a fairy tale for paranoids. And a really interesting thing in it, he lays down something he calls Selene's Laws. There are three laws, the first one being national security is the chief cause of national insecurity. And I thought, that's really brilliant, because, you know, you take like an average person. Average person's walking down the street, just being a person. They face certain dangers from somebody like a mugger or somebody looking for a victim. But if you can present yourself in a way, as you're walking down the street, to be aware, and you're looking out for yourself, and you're paying attention to what's going on around you, your average thug is going to just pass you and look for an easier target. If, on the other hand, you're going around approaching people and getting tough with them and shoving people around and telling them how you want them to live and how you want them to behave, at some point, somebody's going to bust you in the face.
Right.
So the two most dangerous positions to be in is to be just wandering around totally unaware, or to be an obnoxious, loud, irritating person who pushes themselves upon everybody else around them.
Right.
These two positions, one can get you mugged, the other can get you killed.
Right.
So if we look at the way a nation can act, if you have, say, troops stationed in a few hundred countries with over 1,000 bases and 500,000 men in foreign countries, 500,000 soldiers of one kind or another in foreign countries, does that provoke a positive reaction by all those other countries? Or does that cause them to think, what a jerk. This guy's coming around in my face telling me what to do all the time. I'm getting a little tired of it.
Especially since, you know, we've been a country for a little over 200 years now, and we're going to countries who have been around for
thousands
of years,
yeah.
And we're going, hey, you should be more like us.
Yeah.
You should adopt our system.
Because our system works so well.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing applies. Now, that's for, like, international policy, or for foreign policy. But the same thing applies within the borders of a country. If the nation, if the state, keeps a thumb right on top of everybody, they want to look in your business, see what's going on, what are you doing, why are you walking down the street, do you have your identification, what's in your pockets? If the state treats its citizens like that, well, look at London.
Yeah.
The other thing the state does, which they did in England, is you teach an entire class of people to be fully dependent upon the handouts of the state.
Yep.
Then, when things are not doing so well, and you have to cut back slightly or whatever, you're going to have mobs on your hands.
I don't understand. This goes back to the stupid or evil question, because all it takes is to just peek into a history book. You don't even have to read it. You just open it and glance at it, and you'll see that every single civilization, every massive state has fallen because they had gotten to the point where all of their citizens were dependent upon the state for food.
Yeah.
And then something happened and they couldn't give them food.
There becomes more tax consumers than tax producers.
Yeah. And that's how every state has fallen.
Yeah.
Across the board.
I saw a thing where there's some British politician that says, you know, if I could do a British accent, I would do one right now, even at the risk of irritating our British listeners. I'm sorry, but I would. But this politician says, you know, what we could do is whenever we identify one of these rioters, cut off their all the free goodies that they get from the government. And I read that and I thought, you have got to be kidding me. You're sitting here paying these people who are burning your city?
Yeah.
And you consider, perhaps we should stop paying them.
Yeah, but at the same time, if they did that...
Yeah, they'd all riot.
Yeah.
Because that's what you've trained them to do. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, I see these people with... I don't see them personally. I see them at a distance because I wouldn't have anything to do with people like this. But there are people who train dogs for fighting. And they teach the dog to behave in a certain way by horribly treating the dog. Mm-hmm. They train the dog to be mean. We could leave that in. Somebody forgot to turn off their phone.
Somebody who's got a big beard and long hair forgot to turn their phone off.
We could take that out, or we could leave it in. But either way, it happened. So what was I talking about?
Dog fighting.
Oh, yeah. So there are these people, these horrible, wretched monsters of human beings, and they take one of the most wonderful animals in the world, and they train it to be horribly mean by being mean to it. Mm-hmm. And they mistreat these dogs, and they teach them that this is what life is. And then occasionally, one of them will get their arm half bit off by one of these dogs. Mm-hmm. And so they get mad, and they kill the dog. But what would you expect?
Right.
How would you expect the dog to react? If you've treated the dog like this consistently its whole life, then how would you expect that dog to act any differently?
Yeah, I have a tendency to look at it, you know, every now and again you'll be at the grocery store and you'll see some kid just on the floor screaming and wailing.
Oh, yeah.
And flopping around, and the parent gives in and gets them whatever goodie they want to make them shut up.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're surprised when the kid throws a tantrum again.
Yeah.
It's like, well, you've taught them that if they throw a tantrum, they get a goodie.
Yeah, you reward behavior.
Yeah.
That's the best way to encourage someone to do something is to reward that behavior.
Yeah, and positive reinforcement works way better at behavior modification than negative reinforcement does. So if you want somebody to do something...
Mm-hmm.
Rewarding them to do it is a lot more effective than punishing them if they don't do it.
So reward someone for not having a job. Reward someone for having lots of kids with no support for them. Reward a couple for separating after they have children.
Mm-hmm.
Reward all this behavior that in the past there was a built-in mechanism that punished it, or at least didn't reward it.
Mm-hmm.
And now we've got all of society giving money forcibly to, and here's the amazing part, and then we look at that person that has been rewarded for this behavior,
mm-hmm.
and we're mad at them for doing exactly what we've taught them to do.
Yep.
It's amazing.
And people just... They fall right into these patterns that they're being led into,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's sheer propaganda because they take this, you know, this lower class and they make them dependent upon the state.
Yeah. And then they
take
them.
The middle class mm-hmm. and they go, look, see, they're not doing anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. They turn one group against the other. That's absolute characteristic of the state. It will always do that. It will always divide the public, and then it will take one group and point it against the other constantly. Yep. And it doesn't matter who. It will take those poorer classes and point upwards to the at the more wealthy and say, they're stealing from you. They're making you
down.
Yeah, they're forcing you to be like this because they never let you have a chance. They never give you that job. They never do this. They never do that. They always do this. They always do that. And it's all a lie. It's all just meant to keep that poor class poor. And they're doing the same thing to the next class up. They're pointing upward to them and saying, see those rich guys up there with their factories and their corporations and their Wall Street accounts? Those guys are keeping you down here. They're the reason why you can't make it. And you see those guys down there below you? Those guys are stealing from you constantly.
Yep.
And you can, they're dangerous. Look at them. Look at them. They're dangerous. And this constant fear and anger towards other classes. This is exactly what the state does.
Yep.
It always does this.
Yep.
And then when one group misbehaves in the slightest, then the state comes in and just whacks it on the head. And when it reacts to that, then it points and it says, look, look, he's reacting.
Yep.
And we need more money so that we can beat this guy into submission, you know.
Yep.
And so then, the fearful masses of this other group are more than willing, oh, yeah, we have to have more police because those groups down there are so, they're animals. That's
yep.
what they are. They're animals. And so it's a self-perpetuating loop. It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. But the funny thing is that the state can never see the ultimate end of this, which is what you were referring to in a minute ago. It always gets to the point of where that group on the bottom gets so big and so powerful that they just violently react and they just rip things apart.
Well, what ends up happening is you get, you know, the state makes the middle class poorer and poorer and poorer until there is no middle class. There's just the poor and the rich.
Yeah.
And then the rich leave.
Yeah.
Because it's
or just stop investing.
Yeah, it's an incredibly unstable society, and they're not going to risk their money. So they take it away. And then suddenly the state has no funding because the middle class, they've made the poor, and the rich are now gone.
Yeah.
So they can't feed the poor anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so the poor gets really, really violent and ends up, you know, cutting people's heads off in the middle of the town.
Now, here's the fun part of that loop. So you have your revolution. You get all the people with their fun masks. You get your revolution that you're dying for. The revolution happens. You get a little bit of a revenge out of your blood. The state falls. The state's burned. There's nothing left of it. What do? You rise it back up out of its ashes and you make a new state.
Yeah.
Now, there's this little moment when the state doesn't quite have the power that it had before it fell, and there's opportunities for a working class to have just a moment of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And they take advantage of that, and they start developing wealth right away, and they start getting productive. And the richer class that's been sitting on their money, they start injecting wealth back in, and production starts to go, and everybody starts to make more money, and the state is still in charge. It's just not as powerful as it used to be.
Yep.
So then it starts to grow, and it starts to make those divides again. And the process just repeats itself and repeats itself and repeats itself. And so few catch on.
Yep. And it's a never-ending cycle, you know, until it gets to the point where people refuse to start that cycle up again.
Yeah.
Refuse to allow the state to come back into power. And are not content to just make it small. They absolutely kill it.
Yeah. And the killing is not done by the revolution, by the burning, by the attacking, by the destruction. The killing is done by just stepping back and not supporting it when it's small and young.
Yep.
You can't really, it's for us today. I mean, we talk about we can do things to be independent. We can grow some of our own stuff. We can avoid using the methods and the processes and all the industry of the state. And we can provide a certain amount of independence for ourselves. But the truth is, and while the state is the size that it is, we can only achieve so much independence because its tentacles are wrapped around so many things in the world. And the temptation is so great to say, you know, hack off that tentacle, attack it, kill it. But for each person who jumps out and takes a slash at it, it will point all of its many fingers at you and say, see, that guy's the problem right there. Mm-hmm. He's got mental problems, or he's a radical, he's a hard right winger, or he's a crazy leftist, he's an anarchist, he's a this, he's a that, and they'll label you, and they'll put you with a whole group of other people who are not like you at all, and that will justify them coming in, taking you away, and then they know how to deal with you.
Yep.
It's a problem solved.
Yeah, and, you know, it's an issue of, you can't, you know, there's so many people think that if you can just get it down to a small enough point, mm-hmm. that then it will be easier to ignore it.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that you can't get, nobody is going to sit there and ignore the harmless little,
yeah.
you know, oh, it's so cute, it's protecting us, it's doing good.
All the state ever does is build roads and put canals in, yep. and help us with drainage ditches and,
you know,
protect us from the bad guys.
Other states yeah. have gotten out of control, but we know how to control ours.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds like an addict.
Yeah,
doesn't it?
It does. It's an addiction.
I know. Last month, I got out of control, and, you know, but this month, things are going to be different because, you know, last month, I fell back, and I, you know, did this drug, and that got me going with that, and these things happen, but this month's going to be different. You see, you'll see. I'm straightened out. I'm clean, you know?
Yep.
The problem is, if you're still using,
yeah,
even a little tiny bit, that addict, no matter what you're addicted to, if you think you can control the addiction by just using a little bit,
yeah,
not going to work.
Nope,
it's still got you.
Yep, and you know, the addict metaphor is actually kind of funny because we were talking about the death of the state, and mm-hmm. you had mentioned people were like, well, you know. How do you know that this is how it's going to end? And how do you know that this is how it's going to...
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly the process that an addict goes through.
Yeah, yeah. The thrashing out at everyone around him, blaming others, blaming everybody around him. Yet,
attacking people that support you.
Yeah, attacking your best supporters, attacking them and blaming them for all your problems. And yet, begging them to forgive you, begging them to let you back in the house, begging them to give you one more chance. This is all, this is what the state does. It's what it always does, and it's what addicts do. Mm-hmm. It's this exact same thing.
So, the second rule.
Oh, that's where we were, huh? Okay. So, let me reread the first rule, Selene's Law. National security is the chief cause of national insecurity. Okay, law number two. Accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. I find that fascinating. So, for example, Kai, let's say you work for me. I have the power to give you a raise or give you a lowered pay. Mm-hmm. I have the power to fire you. I have the power to lay you off. I have the power to cut your hours, give you less work, give you more work. I have the power to dump a bunch of unfair work on you. Is it possible for us to have an honest, clear communication?
Right. No, because
it can't be.
You know, I can't come up to you and be like, hey, you know, I think the way you're running things is really stupid.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and that nobody's buying that comb over.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's buying the comb over. Just, you know, get rid of it.
Yeah.
You can't do that.
Yeah.
So no honest communication can take place. Now, I can talk down to you, my employee, but that's not really communication. Mm-hmm. You don't get honest communication. And without honest communication, you can't have accurate communication.
Right.
Because all communication is a two-way process. They can't see my hands right now, can they?
No, they can't.
So that's really interesting. So then, what are the repercussions of that on government? If government has the ability to utilize aggressive force against us, then there can never be honest communication between the people and the government.
Right.
So the only way the government can have honest communication with people is if the government is not a state and does not utilize aggressive force.
Right. Well, we can see this in so-called, you know, freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a protest, and you can protest all you want, but if you have the fear that the cops are going to come in and riot gear and pepper spray all of you, you know, that's not really conducive to being honest and open and having freedom of speech.
I don't know if I can connect these things to what we're talking about, but the thought just popped into my head, so I need to get it out. I want to contrast. Are you aware of the huge protests going on in Israel right now?
The ones in Tel Aviv?
Yeah, in Tel Aviv. I want to contrast what's going on in Israel and Tel Aviv to the ones that are going on in, say, what was going on in Spain and Greece and what's now going on in the UK. There's a huge difference between a crowd in Israel, a good portion of which are armed, and have absolutely no fear of the government or anything else.
Right.
And
because they are the army of the government.
Yeah. And a group of people in, say, London, where the oppression is so horrible that they're not even allowed to defend themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're in Tel Aviv and you've got a sign that says, I hate what the government is doing, this thing that the government is doing is bad, this has to stop, and you've got an Uzi under your jacket or whatever, perfectly legal, or if you're a very poor youth in London and you've got a sign that says the exact same thing in English as the guy in Tel Aviv has got in Hebrew, you've got that sign, except you are entirely unarmed and helpless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the two protesters in the two cities look up and they see a row of gentlemen wearing all black outfits with their faces blacked out from a hood.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about anarchists.
Mm-mm.
And they're wearing a helmet with a visor, and they've got a big plastic shield in front of them, and they've got impressive boots and impressive batons and all this stuff. And behind them is a row of guys dressed similarly with pepper spray bombs that they can shoot over at you and pepper spray an entire area. Or they've got canisters that they can shoot over with tear gas or whatever the gas is. And you look over at them, and you think, they're not going to charge me.
Right.
They're not going to hit me with a baton. And the guy in the uniform, the guy in the black outfit with the plastic shield, he knows what those guys are carrying out there in the protests. So he's not going to run up and just start batoning somebody.
No.
But that same situation in London has an entirely different formula. When that protester is absolutely helpless to defend himself, the very nature of dominance, when you have a row of people, and I'm not judging the individuals in that row of people, but when you have a row of people and they are all dressed identical and their faces are hidden and they're all armed and they're all wearing shields and all the equipment and all the regalia that goes with it, human nature demands that they will act in a certain dominant manner.
Mm-hmm.
They feel. Now, anybody who's listening who's ever been in a uniform and has ever been side by side with a row of guys uniformed just like yourself, you know what you're what I'm talking about if you're honest with yourself. You have a certain feeling of dominance, a certain feeling of invulnerability.
Yep.
And you know that your team can do what it wants to do. And your team can take out those guys anytime it wants.
Yep.
But if you're lined up like that, and you know that if your team charges that group of protesters, your team loses, then you have a whole different attitude.
Yep.
So my point is, the riot police in Tel Aviv are going to behave totally different from the riot police in London.
Mm-hmm.
And that means the crowd is going to behave totally different.
Yep.
the crowd in London is frustrated and angry and mad, and they can't do anything about it. So they strike out in ways that they, the only way that they have left for them.
Yep.
In Tel Aviv, not necessary. It's just not necessary. Now, am I making an excuse for burning London? Not at all. What I'm saying is, if you are out in, let's put you out in an Arizona desert, and you find a rock pile, and you start poking around in that rock pile, and you stick your hand back in there and a snake bites you, the snake did exactly what the snake is supposed to do. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the snake is good or bad. That means the snake did predictable behavior.
Right.
And if you take a human being and you teach them their whole life to be dependent upon the government and don't get a job, or if you do get a job, it's just for side cash. Because really, the government is what pays you for everything.
Right.
And then you take those same people and you forcibly disarm them. You create a helpless situation. And then you bring in cops who will routinely frisk them and search them for no reason whatsoever, other than the fact that they're poor and they're in this neighborhood. Now, you have created a situation like that snake. Mm-hmm. And when you get bit, you got bit because of what you did.
Yep.
Now, that doesn't mean that the snake didn't bite you.
Right.
That doesn't mean, I mean, if I got bit by a snake, the first thing I'd do is try to kill the snake.
Right.
So, I'm not saying that these people in London are innocent or we should forgive them. I'm not saying any of those things.
Right.
An anarchist or a libertarian should never destroy property you don't own.
Right.
So I'm not making any excuses for individual actions. But what I'm saying is, if you stick your hand in the snake's den, you shouldn't be angry at the snake when it bites you.
Yep.
You should realize it's doing exactly what it's made to do.
Yep.
And humans, when you treat them in certain ways, they will react in certain ways.
Yeah.
It's just 1 plus 1 equals 2. That's the way it goes. It can't be 1 plus 1 equals 3. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
Or I guess Orwell said 2 plus 2, didn't he?
I think so.
Well, he was wrong. So that's my rant on that. Oh, I got off the topic again. I somehow took accurate communication and went back to national security. This is not a very structured podcast today.
We seem to be doing that a lot.
Okay, so the first one was, national security is the chief cause of national insecurity. Number two, accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. Oh, I know where I was going with all that is that they're in a non-punishing situation. The people in London, the protesters, were always under the boot mm-hmm. of the people that they're trying to communicate their problem to. So all the peaceful protests that they did over the last few months got no press, no media coverage whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And the government didn't take notice of them at all because they didn't have that equal communication.
Right.
But you know what? The guys in Tel Aviv, those protesters are on equal level.
Mm-hmm.
And you can bet that the government in Israel is listening to those protesters.
Yep.
Because you're sitting there surrounded the way Israel is on every side with enemies. If you make enemies of your own people, that's not a good soup.
You don't have a country anymore.
No, that's not a tasty soup. That's not good eats. Okay, so that's accurate communications is possible only in a non-punishing situation. Humans, people, regular guys walking around, regular ladies walking around, cannot have an honest communication with a government if the government has the advantage of aggressive force.
Right.
You, in order to have a government that's legitimate, that you can communicate with, to communicate your needs and your wants and your desires, and the government communicating with you what's required of you to behave in a way that works among this society. The only way you can get that balance is with an honest and even fair communication where one side is not doesn't have the ability to punish the other side.
Isn't that the non-aggression principle?
Pretty much. And now that doesn't mean, somebody might translate to say, well, that means somebody can't be punished for if they do bad. No. The non-aggression principle respects property rights, and a person can defend their property, even using excessive violence to do it.
But that's not aggression.
That's not aggression. That's defense, and defense acts of defense are perfectly legitimate.
Despite what our national government would have you believe, there is a severe difference between
aggression,
defense and aggression.
Absolutely. Okay, so that's number one and two. Number three is, here it comes, an honest politician is a national calamity. That's a kind of a hard one to swallow.
Right.
But I should have looked up that guy's name. Blanco? Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yeah.
He was the governor of Illinois. Blagojevich. Blagojevich is his actual name. The media, being the lazy slugs that they are, labeled him Blago in all their headlines because they're too lazy to type out the rest of the letters. Anyway, you see this guy. Now, he was arrested, and he had some convictions, and it was a nasty mess. He was evidently trying to sell Barack Obama's old senatorial seat, and he's found guilty of
some
other...
Wouldn't be surprised if he gets reelected, though.
I wouldn't be surprised either. Well, there have been politicians who were actually reelected while in jail.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, you take a look at the picture of this guy, and it's like, how can you look at him and not realize that he's a crook?
Right.
Now, I hate to be like this, but the simple fact is, you know, I have been offended when people have looked at me, because I'm kind of not normal looking. and I have been offended when someone takes one look at me. Like, I don't know if you remember it or not. One time you and Hannah and I went to the local mall, to the Dayton Mall, and we... Together, we walked in, this was a few years back, and we didn't even get, you know, we went in through one of those long extended wings that doesn't have any shops attached to it, and so before we even got into the main body of the mall, we already had security on our tail walking behind us because of my looks. And when I stopped and turned around to look at the guy, he comes right up to me and says, "Is there something you're looking for? Can I help you with something?" Well, why would you think that?
Right.
You know, we come to this mall all the time. I know every shop in the mall. Why would you think that?
Right.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he was just being customer service and friendly.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I kind of get upset when people judge a person by first glance and by their looks. On the other hand, you can look at some people and just listen to them talk for a minute and look at the way that they behave, look at their mannerisms and so forth, and you can know right off, this guy is slime. This guy is a crook.
Yeah.
This guy has no morals. He will say anything. He will do anything. And I don't know. I guess everybody doesn't have that same level of awareness. But the first time I saw this Blagojevich... Yeah, Blagojevich. First time I saw him, I thought, oh, look at that guy. That's a slimy politician.
Yep. and you know, there's something to be said for slimy politicians, because at least you know what they're going to do.
Yeah, like, you know.
You can always trust their motives.
Yeah, who's shocked when a slimy politician gets arrested? When you see a politician, you think, I don't like that guy. And then you find out he was arrested in a airport bathroom for making advances on a cop. And you think, huh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And it speaks volumes, since that's the guy who was directly attacking that lifestyle.
Right.
And then you find out, well, that's why he was attacking that lifestyle.
Right.
Because he was so conflicted in his own brain and he couldn't live with himself.
Yep.
So he is a hypocrite and he's a slime. And then you see somebody like this governor that we're talking about here, that I'm butchering his name, and you take one look at him, you listen to him talk, and you think, well, I know exactly how he's going to behave.
Right.
You know, this was the thing when I used to hang around with a lot of bikers. there were some bikers that were really nasty guys. I mean, they were seriously dangerous. They were, there were some hardcore guys. And I never felt at all threatened by them.
Right.
Because I knew the rules. I knew that as long as you don't cross that guy, you should expect his behavior to be in a certain way. And as long as you realize that, you know how to deal. Let's go back to the snake. As long as you know the snake is there,
yeah,
the snake is not a threat. You don't go sticking your hand down in his snake hole. But, you know, as long as you know he's there, you know how he's going to behave, you know the kind of place that he's going to be found, then you can compensate for that and not stick your hand down in the rocks.
Right.
On the other hand, what was the rest of that? Oh, an honest politician is a national calamity. Now, why would an honest politician be a national calamity?
Because you have no idea what he's going to do.
Yeah. Because he thinks that he can use the aggression of the state to do good.
Yeah.
An honest politician, a good politician, not a good politician, that's a kind of a little bit of an oxymoron there, but an honest person who goes into politics to try to do good and change things for the better, they're really dangerous.
Yeah.
Because once they get the power of the state within their hands and they decide to start doing good with it, now you've got somebody who's really unpredictable.
Yeah, and almost never when you have the power of the state and you say, I'm going to do this because this is good or this is going to bring about good, it never does. It always makes things worse.
Mm-hmm. Bastiat's law, you know, there's that which is seen and there is that which is not seen.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you see good results from the actions of the state, what you don't see is the long-term calamity that it's created. And as certain as the short-term good is, that is how certain the long-term calamity is.
I mean, when you really look at it, welfare and Social Security and all of these things, they were designed to do good.
Yeah, all those things were not meant to destroy, you know, our economy. It was good-hearted people thinking they were doing the right thing, supporting, you know, who wouldn't want Social Security? Everybody can retire and be comfortable and not be a burden on their family. Who wouldn't want such a thing?
Yeah, well...
Well,
this
when
is
the,
where it gets us.
Yeah, yeah, it gets us to the point of where we're going to have a generation of people who have grown dependent on it, and it dies right before their eyes before they have a chance to die, and they're going to be stuck. And hopefully a solution can come up before that takes place, but, you know, if you play the game out long enough, you're going to have an entire generation of dependent people and nothing to support them.
Yep.
And you've taught their children not to support them.
Yep.
And you've taught them not to save for the future. Now, what are you going to do? Well, let's see. You've created exactly what's in London, what the people in the UK are dealing with.
Yep.
The only difference is they're all old.
Yeah.
So now there's a good and a bad. The young person who's angry has a hot temper that flares up and cools right back down again.
Yeah.
Old people who are angry don't cool down.
Yeah.
They won't get as hot, but they don't cool down.
Yep.
They're dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, look at who led the, you know, American War for Independence.
Mm.
It wasn't 17-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, it was established members of society.
Mm-hmm. So an honest politician is a national calamity because in their attempt to do good, they will actually use the force of the state, the aggression and all the evil aspects of the state in an attempt to do good with it. But they, because of their honesty, can actually do more harm than the bad politician.
And even if they are doing legitimately good things and they are really helping the economy and they're building everything up, the problem is when you get a politician honestly doing good things and making the country stronger and all of this, from an anarchist point of view, that's also bad.
You're making the evil government work.
Yeah. Let's not take this horrific, terrible, horrible machine and make it more efficient.
Here's an airplane analogy. Let's say you're sitting on the tarmac in an airplane.
Which we're going to go with the movie Airplane.
Oh. What can you make out of this, Bob? I can make a hat. No, you've got an airplane. It's a big airplane. And it's sitting on the tarmac, and it's packed full of people. And the pilot's running through the things. He looks at the flaps. He checks the engines. He's looking at all the numbers and all the gauges, and he's making sure everything's ready. He's doing all his normal routine process that he goes through to clear the plane before he rolls out onto the runway. And he notices that there's a problem with one of his instruments. It's indicating that there's a problem. So he calls in real quick to the repair guys, and they're like, hey, we'll take care of this, no problem. And so a guy comes running out with a roll of duct tape, and you see him out on the wing. He's like standing on the wing, duct taping this big section down, just duct taping away on the wing. And you look out there, and you're like, yeah, that's a good idea. Fix this thing just enough to get us back in the air again. See? Well, that's not good.
Yeah.
And if you look at that as the state, and you realize that the state is a massive, unstable monster that just flies around the world doing the things that it does, and you want to keep it bandaged up and keep it functioning so that it continues to do what it does, just slightly less.
Right.
Well, what's the end result of what you're doing here, you know? The other thing that I was thinking of, and this is turning towards the geek side, I was thinking of a story where there's this object. It's a... I don't think the word magic is used, but I like to use the word magic because I like Penn and Teller, so I'll use the word magic. And I like James Randi, so I'll use the word magic. Okay, so you have this object. It's a magic object, and it has all kinds of power. This object happens to be in the hands of this really innocent person who is deeply innocent. I mean, not just naive, but really, really a good-hearted, very innocent person. Mm-hmm. And it's just in his pocket. And he doesn't really even know what it is or what it'll do or anything else about it. In that situation, the object apparently is harmless.
Right.
Mostly because he doesn't know what it is or how to use it, and he doesn't try to use it. It's right. Just there. Occasionally, he'll bring it out and look at it, and it makes him feel funny, but then he'll put it back in his pocket. But over time, this starts affecting him. And finally, at some point, he realizes that he has to get away from everybody he knows. And he doesn't know really why. He just has these feelings that he can't deal with anymore. And he's just being overwhelmed with these feelings. And whenever these feelings begin to overwhelm him like that, he reaches into his pocket and he touches this object. Mm-hmm. And it helps. And he has this friend. And this friend is really, really, really smart. And so he comes by to visit, and the friend sees the change that's taken place in him. And he says, are you okay? And yeah, I'm fine. And the friend notices him with his hand in his pocket, touching the object. He's like, do you still have that thing? Yeah, I have it. You know what? Here, you take it. And the friend, the wise, smart friend, goes, I'm not going to touch that thing. No, I don't even want to touch it. Keep it over there. Put it in this envelope. And I'm not even going to touch the thing. Now, have I made that obvious enough? Do we know what object we're talking about here?
I do, at least. But then, you know.
So this is the basic story of the ring in The Lord of the Rings.
Right.
This innocent little guy has it and doesn't really know what it is. But the guy who knows what it is, even though he's ultimate good in the story,
right.
The Gandalf character is the ultimate good in the story, he knows, he's smart enough to know, the power that thing has, I don't want to touch.
Yep.
I would pick it up and I would try to do something good with it. But what would come out of that would be so horrible that it would make bad look good.
Yeah.
It would be that bad. And then, just so you're certain to understand this concept that's made so clear by the writer, he does this over and over throughout the story.
Yeah.
So the innocent guy's got it, but it's tearing him up. It's just constantly eating at him just to be in his pocket, much less if he accidentally puts it on.
Yep.
And eventually he gets to another perfect person, the lady.
Galadriel.
Thank you. See, I'm not as bad a geek as you are. And in such frustration and so overwhelmed by this ring, he says, take this. And she's actually tempted to, but she's wise enough to know that this would destroy everything.
Yep.
If I had it, with my goodness and my wisdom and my age and all the intelligence that I have, I would destroy everything with it.
Yep.
Because that's what evil does to you. And that's not good enough. The writer's got to tell you again the same story. So he takes this brave soldier. So you've got this guy, and it's his only desire to serve his country, to serve his king, to serve his nation and his people.
And really, you know, because when you read the books, Boromir can, and especially if you watch the movie, can sometimes come off as, you know, he just wants the power. But honestly, in the book, he really wants to do good with it. His mm-hmm. goal is to defeat Sauron.
Yeah,
and save his people. He's all about, you know, we can get rid of it after we do that, but let us use this power that we have, mm-hmm. you know.
Why throw this away?
Yeah.
When we have this that we can use for good.
Yeah.
And it kills him.
Yeah. And, it, you know, it always does. You can't, you know, you can't use a little bit of that power.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even use power that's in the similar area as that power, you know? They had other rings that they couldn't even use to defeat this.
Right.
You know, they couldn't use any of it
mm-hmm.
because it was in that same league.
Now, only part of this is clear in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to read the books and with an open eye mm-hmm. to see this in the story. Because, to be honest, to be brutally honest, Peter Jackson didn't get it.
No.
He,
I don't even know that he read the books.
I don't know if he did or not. He made fantastic movies, you know. I'm not saying the movies weren't good. From a Hollywood point of view, these were fantastic movies. But I don't think he ever got Tolkien and what mm-hmm. Tolkien was saying in those books.
No.
Some of his writers might have, but they were so hindered by the rules of the production company and the rules of the studios.
Yeah, you watch when they do the part where they talk over the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And they're like, and here we were going to do it like they had in the book. And then Peter Jackson said we were going to do it this way.
Yeah,
and
that's in the, we've got these, we're total geeks. We've got the extended behind the scenes version.
I don't, because I don't approve of the movies.
Well, somebody around here has that. The set that looks like a set of books. Anyway.
I refused to buy the books for the longest time until they stopped having the covers be pictures from the movies.
But the other soldier in the movie, mm-hmm. or in the book, that refused to take the ring when offered to him.
Mm-hmm. Which they didn't make clear in the movie.
They really didn't. There was one moment where Frodo said that he would give it to him, and he turned it down. But that was not as clear in the movie as the impact that it had in the book. Because,
right.
you know, you can take 20 pages and cover something in a book, whereas
right.
in Hollywood, yeah, hey, we got to keep this thing rolling.
Right.
We're burning.
We got a battle scene here. We got to...
I got 10,000 Maoris all dressed up. And then if we don't get them lunch, they're going to be ripping something apart. But yeah, that wasn't really made as clear as it could have been, that he had the opportunity. Well, not only him. The head of the elves, boy, I'm really bad with the names. Back in...
Elrond?
Yeah, Elrond had the opportunity. When the ring was brought to him, he could have just said, I'll take it. you know.
Yeah, but he didn't, and he didn't even want it to stay in his city.
He wanted it out of his city at all costs, because he knew what it would bring to him, you know. So the ultimate is you have to, you know, put it back to where it came from. Mm-hmm. You can't use it. You can't put it on. You can't utilize it. It destroys you to have it. And that's what the good politician, that's the problem with the good politician. He's going to think, well, I can use this for good. But as he wields the power of the state, it changes him. And the more he uses that, the more it changes him, and it twists his ability to see good from bad. And eventually, you know, you've got, well, we're just going to try to help the poor in these, you know, in these unfortunate few in these inner cities that are struggling so hard. And it breaks your heart to see people struggling that bad.
Yep.
But as the state uses its fists to come in and fix things, all it does is crush and crush and crush.
Yep. Yeah, it can't do anything else. The state can't fix. It doesn't have that as a tool.
No. So, that was a long time to get through three simple points. National security is the chief cause of national insecurity. Accurate communication is possible only in a non-punishing situation. And an honest politician is a national calamity. That's from The Illuminati Papers by Robert Anton Wilson, which has been referred to as a fairy tale for paranoids. Well, that's us.
Isn't every day a fairy tale for paranoids?
Yeah. I don't know. Fairy tales generally end up good.
SpongeBob! I wanted to bring up SpongeBob!
Let's do SpongeBob.
SpongeBob! So, I was at my friend's house, and she's got a stepkid and a stepson, and he's like three,
mm-hmm.
and we were watching SpongeBob SquarePants, and now, I'm not a huge SpongeBob aficionado, I don't know every nuance of SpongeBob, but as we were watching these, it came to my attention that SpongeBob SquarePants is an anarcho-capitalistic society. As they were putting, there's the bad guy, Plankton,
mm-hmm.
and he put in this highway.
He runs a restaurant.
Yeah. Yes. That's,
and it's in competition with the good guy, what's his name?
Mr. Krabs. Yeah.
Mr. Krabs has one restaurant on one side of town, and Plankton has a restaurant on the other side of town.
So Plankton decided that he was going to get more business to his restaurant by building a highway directly to his restaurant.
So a businessman takes it on his own to build a road.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's pretty interesting.
But now he got the proper permits, right?
I would assume so.
So then they decided that the road was a bad idea.
Yeah, because
they didn't like where it went through.
So the people of the town, like not, you know, the police or mm-hmm. anything, just like the guys.
Was it like an angry mob?
Kind of. Kind of. But they were like, no, we're done with your road. And
mm-hmm.
they took the road up. And it wasn't like, you know, we're removing your permits and we're going to have town hall meetings about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was just like, no, so, we don't like this.
So it wasn't the fist of the government acting.
No.
It was individuals in the community that decided that their community standards did not want a road through that particular section.
Yep.
And so the community standard went in and took care of the situation without the fist of the state.
And there was no fines for Mr. Plankton, and there was no putting him in jail, and nobody burned down his restaurant.
Did they have a vote?
I don't think they did. Or I suppose you could say that they had the most open and democratic of votes.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Which is, we're going to go do this. Let's go.
Because I don't think, you know, I thought about this for a while. I don't think that you can have truly open and honest politics and elections unless you are willing to say, I support this guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if it's a secret ballot,
mm-hmm.
it's not.
Yeah.
It's not going to end up in being fair and honest and open.
Well, in the olden days with juries, this is back when juries were actually like they were designed to be. you would have the jury, they didn't have a secret meetings off to the side where they, and then they came back and they, you know, anonymously said, this is the decision of the jury. The jury was right there, they listened, and then the judge looked right at each one and said, how do you vote? Mm-hmm. How do you vote? Mm-hmm. How do you vote? And they're right there voting in front of the community.
Yep.
who can scrutinize that jury. These guys on the jury know, when I get up and walk out here, the whole town is going to know exactly how I chose.
Yep.
And so this forces honesty upon people. In the olden days, also with juries, the jury was actually of our peers.
Right.
Which doesn't mean that you go around and collect people who can't figure out how to get out of jury duty and, you know,
people who are so stupid that they haven't read the newspapers or watched TV or been on the internet.
Yeah. That's not a jury of our peers. So literally, if I got accused of something, they would get 12 people that knew me and say, here's the case against him. Is this consistent with what you feel about him?
Yep.
Is he the kind of a person who would do this? And that's how a jury made those decisions.
Yep.
But then again, we get the jury system predominantly from the Nordic, from the Vikings and the Nordic people, prior to them having a king when they still lived under anarchy.
Yep.
Okay, so SpongeBob is an anarchist.
Anyway, I thought that was really interesting, because you so very rarely see positive anarchist role models on TV, especially for children.
Mm-hmm.
So often you see socialism or statism, and seeing anarchy, seeing somebody who, you know, goes to work and lives in his house, and you never see him, you know, pay taxes. You never see him. You know, there are police in Bikini Bottom.
Right. But there would be police in an anarchy.
Right.
In an anarcho-capitalist system.
But, you know, you never see sales tax. You never see any of that.
That's the case in several cartoons. You know, Jeffrey Tucker, we were talking about that with
Jetsons.
In the Jetsons, there's no actual government.
There's space police there, too.
Sure, there's police, there's even traffic courts and things like that. But you can have all those things within an anarcho-capitalist society. Now, here's my question, though. The writers of that SpongeBob episode, or the writers of Jetsons, or, you know, whatever, I wonder if they are intentionally, if they know what they wrote, or if the truth of anarchism is so deep within ourselves that when they write without thinking about it, that's what comes out.
Yep. Or if it's one of those things where, you know, having to explain to children what government is and why, you know, because when a child looks at how you would have to portray government for it to be accurate.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to have to explain that to a 5-year-old child.
Yeah, that is quite a contradiction. When we tell a child, okay, you can't steal from other children.
Mm-hmm.
You can't aggress upon other children. You have to tell mommy the truth. Always tell the truth. Tell mommy the truth. Do not steal from your friends. Do not steal from the other kids.
Don't hit.
Don't pull their hair. Don't bite them. And you tell them these things, and you teach them to be truthful. You teach them to be loving. You teach them to share by choice. You teach them not to steal. You teach them these things, and then they see the government, and they go to school where they're forced to sit still, shut up, or you'll be punished.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot behave in a normal, natural way in a school. You have to raise your hand to go to the bathroom. You have to walk where everybody else walks. You have to do what everybody else is doing. You have to be quiet while we're doing this. And then they get their first tastes of government, wherever that might be in their life. And they expect for government to act in a certain way, an honest and a peaceful way. But government, polluted by the state, behaves in an dishonest way, in an aggressive, violent way, in a harmful way, in a destructive way.
Yep.
And so there's this contradiction that's constantly going on. And so if you're honest with a kid and you say, this is what the state's like. This is what society has tolerated, and this is what you should face when, or this is what you will face when you go out there. But we want you to behave this way. Well, it.
Kids are amazingly good at spotting hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And they won't, you know, you can't teach a child not to steal if you steal.
Right.
You know, you can't teach a child to share if you don't share.
Mm-hmm.
You can't teach a child to be generous if you're not generous.
Or respect property.
Yeah. So, you know, the child will always mirror whatever you are actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if that is the hypocrisy of the state, then they're going to learn that it doesn't matter, you know, you might as well steal, they're going to steal.
Yeah.
You know, you have to lie, otherwise, you know,
mm-hmm.
they're gonna lie, and you know, you have to outwit them mm-hmm. at every step.
Yeah.
You know.
So it trains young people and children and young adults to act like the state.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when you institutionalize them into indoctrination centers for the first 12, 13, 16, 18 years. You know, even universities or yeah. colleges are not quite like, you know, state schools. But you still got a lot of the same pollution yeah. in there.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, thanks for listening, folks. This is BadQuaker.com podcast. And we're at badquaker.com. Folks, thanks a lot for listening. And we won't see you, but you can see us. Well, you can't even
really.
See us. Check back with us Wednesday and
And Thursday.
Oh, and Thursday tomorrow and Wednesday for more badquaker.com. Thanks a lot, folks.